was 2 months old, so I've dealt with his back ever since.
Wow.
But it's something you just live with, you know.
Right.
But I'm not as spry as I used to be. I used to just sort of override the pain and, you know, do peace walks or vigils or whatever.
But you are be very spry. You might not be as spry as you used to be, but you're very spry.
Yeah, I think for 88 I'm doing pretty good.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, we're going, Frank. What is your secret? What's your secret?
That's my secret. I really don't know. I think my secret is just, it's not a secret. It's just that I want to keep on working as long as I can to make life better for all human beings and for our environment. And that's been my life's work, and there's no point in stopping till I get stopped.
Yes. No. R-E-T. No retirement. There's no retirement in your work.
No, really, just slowing down. Slowing down a little, but I don't plan to really retire. I had to retire from working for money because I can't get a job anymore. But as far as the other things go, no, there's no such thing as retirement.
Yes.
Frank's not retired. Look at him. He's going strong.
Both in and in the A R T in the art and in the S O C I social J U justice M movement Y R E retire both. He said both in the art and in the social justice movement. Why retire?
Yeah. No point. My art is writing. I'm not artistic otherwise, but in writing. So I'm trying to finish a book that I've been writing a long time about my work in the nonviolence movements, especially in the last century. I guess there's no retiring from social justice work because we're not there yet.
How? F-A. How far? R. How far are you?
In the book. I'm collecting a lot of things. I've been writing my whole life, and I wrote for newsletters, and I wrote chapters of books, you know, for collections of writings. And How many fund appeals? Don't even ask me. So I'm collecting all of that, partly through the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, which has all the records of the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action, for which I did a lot of the writing. And then I'm writing, you know, I'm putting that together and writing other parts that aren't, that I can't, either I can't find the articles about or I can't, or I need to revise things. So I'm hoping to finish this year. That's my goal. But sometimes there are impediments.
We can keep F finding. Yeah, it's, you know, we have all these file cabinets, and then we have another house filled with file cabinets, and we have a storage area filled with file cabinets.
I know.
And I was going through one of the file cabinets looking for one thing, and I found a file that was called Miscellaneous Articles. You know, and in it were, there was a review that a student had written of Frank's work. I can't remember what that was. Was in UC Berkeley or yeah, a couple things like that that were just gems, just gems that we quickly got Jen to transcribe for us, so Frank has in the computer and can start doing stuff with.
Yeah, well, there's no end of material, but I'm trying to keep it a little bit focused, so. I don't just go off in all different directions.
Right.
So I'm basically doing writing about what I participated in and observed. But I'm also asking people through a questionnaire. I have to hurry up because my generation's dying out fast.
Yeah.
To evaluate what we did. What were some of the most effective things we did? What were ineffective or should have been done better?
What are you, they, what are they saying in response to those questions?
Well, they have, depending on who it is, they have all different responses because I've been in the civil rights movement, I've been in the peace movement, I've been in the women's movement, I've been in the economic justice movement, so I'm trying to get responses from people in those areas.
For you are not they are EA really? One? For you, aren't they all of those really one movement?
Oh, yes, yeah. But different people have emphasized different ones. And so I'm trying to separate them somewhat so I can get comments from people. That were specifically in the area of starting community land trusts and community development loan funds. That's a, to me, that's a very important part of the whole movement.
Yes.
Because Gandhi said there are two sides to the same coin, resistance and positive programs, and so community land trusts were based on Gandhian ideas of holding land in trust. And Vinoba Bhave, whom we met in India, was the Gandhian partner that put that into effect all over India. Went around and asked landholders to give land for people who didn't have it. But then it also, you know, is a basis of this continent because American Indians believed that they held the land in trust for future generations. They never owned land as such, and so there's different, you know, different aspects, and that's one that I was deeply involved in and helped to start several land trusts. But I agree with Gandhi. That's part and parcel of the peace movement, of the human rights movement.
Yes. You? Ken? Ben? B? You? Build? C? R? C? E? N? T? Centers? You can then build centers.
Well, yeah, there are many centers. In India, there are many communities and ashrams based on Gandhian ideas. Unfortunately, India also, you know, has gone in the other direction and developed nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants and that kind of thing. But it was interesting when we visited India, 1978, early 79, they were into solar, like we aren't even there yet. They had solar ovens, solar this, solar that, you know. They were way ahead of us. And then in this country, of course, right where I live in Santa Cruz, there's the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which gets into all kinds of things. They're doing a program now of low-income affordable housing combined with space for small businesses. And they're doing that in cooperation with a Hispanic American group in Santa Cruz, so that there's less division between white people and Hispanic people in the city and the county. And there's just so much going on. Nobody can keep up with all of it. And
why? What? When? U? L? A? S? T? When you last were here?
Here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We? Were T talking about how A artists were should buy buy up the old funky houses in Detroit?
Oh yes.
We were talking about that. Mm-hmm. And then within like a week of you being here, we saw a news segment where artists are buying up the houses in Detroit. They're actually doing that. They're getting them for like, what was it, like
$6,000.
Yeah. And with the idea of building community.
We have a whole new thing down in Santa Cruz. I think it was an old mill. And they've taken it over and they've built houses, residence studios for artists, a very large complex. Mm-hmm. Santa Cruz is sort of famous, I guess, for its artists anyhow. Mm-hmm. And and they don't mean just people that paint, because there's a lot of musicians and a lot of them, like some of the bands. I have some friends in one band in Santa Cruz that travels all over California. They've even been to South America. some of the bands practice. They rent a storage facility, and that's where they practice because there's not enough space.
Right.
So this new place for artists will have more space for them, for groups like them, as well as individual artists.
You? Were? A? F? O? R? A 4? S? H? A? D? O? Shadow? Of C O D code pink. You were a foreshadowing of code pink.
That's a wonderful organization. I'm so impressed. You know, they just went to Iran. Alice Walker went with them, and she's going to be speaking here in a couple of weeks about their trip. But I say that they're the descendants of Women's Strike for Peace, but far more effective than Women's Strike for Peace ever were. This thing that they do at the recruiting center here in Berkeley is amazing. Yeah. They just keep on and on and on. And in Washington, they go to Congress almost every day. And
yes.
I have great admiration for them.
You did it, D, E, you did it, W, I, with J, F, K, you did it with JFK.
Did what?
did what, Frank?
Well, we pressed JFK about the Vietnam War, of course, because he got us into it originally. Congress got us into it, too. But we...
The and A about M... I, L, L, M, I, L, L, M, I, L, K, about milk?
Oh, well, that was a project that we had with several of us who were mothers and grandmothers, and we were trying to get President Kennedy to stop the above-ground, well, all testing of nuclear weapons. But especially the above ground, because the testing was giving us strontium-90, which was getting into milk all over the country through the wind patterns, and that was dangerous for children. So we decided we would try to see President Kennedy, and there were several of us in Washington over a period of a couple of months, mothers and grandmothers, and we kept calling for appointments. We called the White House appointment secretary, and but we were also going around and visiting Congress people. We saw lots of news people, Mary McGrory and Drew Pearson, and who was another one in from the Miami Herald, Ed Leahy, and they usually wrote stories about what we were doing, especially Mary McGrory was very good. She had several. And we went to the Defense Department, and we talked, remember we talked to one scientist there, and we were explaining that not only were we worried about the nuclear testing and the strontium-90, but we were worried about what was going to be done with all the waste from nuclear weapons development and nuclear power and so forth. And some big shot scientist sort of waved his hand and he said, oh, somebody will think of something to do with it. We thought that was a pretty disgusting answer.
Fertilizer.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they used it for fertilizer.
No, I don't think so. What they wanted.
No, you're saying they did that. You did.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
What they want to do, of course, is the nuclear waste is stored all over this country now in not very safe storage places, and what they want to do is bury it in Nevada in a ages-old Indian burial ground. Mm. And the state of Nevada is just absolutely opposed to it. And of course, all the Indian tribes and a whole lot of us are opposed to it. So another idea they have now is shooting it up into the atmosphere, which is even crazier. So we've just got to do something. And I applaud President Obama because he has stated that we need to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he's approaching Russia, and then he's going to approach the other countries. And that's one of the good things he's doing. Mm-hmm. Now, what he's doing that's not good, of course, is sending more and more troops into Afghanistan and the drone planes that are bombing and killing far more civilians than terrorists, and raising the budget for the military. Our military budget already is between 51% and 57% of our total federal budget. And it's more than all the rest of the world's military budgets put together. And that's disgraceful. And so we're asking him to cut the military budget right now by 50%. And of course, we want it to cut down to zero eventually. But think of what we could do with all that money.
Mm-hmm.
That's billions, billions, trillions of dollars. We could do all the environmental stuff that he's talking about. We could give every child an education. We could, practically cure malaria and AIDS in other countries. Think what we could do with that money. Mm-hmm. And we're just wasting it on weapons and killing people. That's a speech.
Be a back to P-O-L-P-O-O-P-O-O-R poor J F-K. Let's go back to poor JFK.
Oh, well, yes. So we kept calling for an appointment. We kept seeing people. We went to see Congress people and senators. And finally, we wrote President Kennedy a letter, and we said on a certain date, we were going to come to the White House. We were going to walk up the driveway to the White House porch, and we were just going to wait there until he could find 15 minutes to talk with us, because he was seeing all kinds of, people from other countries, and it was ridiculous, the number of people and the kinds of people we were seeing, and he couldn't give some mothers a chance to talk to him. So we got all dressed up. We dressed very nicely, and we had hats and gloves on, and we went to the White House, and they escorted us into the sentry office right at the gate. And there, a man from the White House talked to us and promised us he would do everything he could to get an appointment. And we said, we've been here almost 2 months trying to get an appointment. He thought that he talked us out of our plan. We didn't say we weren't going to do it, but he thought he wanted he wanted to think we said it. So he shook our hands and we walked out. Instead of turning left and going out of the gate, we turned right and started walking up the driveway. And the press was there. Mary McGrory was right with us and other press people. And there was quite a lot of consternation because this man had been assigned to stop us and he hadn't stopped us. So the guards chased us up the driveway and we got probably two-thirds of the way up and they stopped us. And they put us into a squad car. Mm-hmm. They took us down to the local police station. And there were only two of us at that time because the other people had had to go home. People were coming and going. And this woman was older than I, Hermine Evans. She was a mother and a grandmother. And there I was. I had four children at that point, and they separated us, and the police talked to us, and they tried to get us to promise that we wouldn't go back, and then they wouldn't charge us. And we both said separately, well, we're not going to go back now, because it's after 5 o'clock, and it's time for the president to have his dinner, but we didn't promise we wouldn't go back at all. And so they let us go. And we returned and we spent 2 or 3 more days trying to get an appointment. And we finally just had to give up because we had other responsibilities and we were out of money. And so we went home and 2 days after I got home, I got a call from the friend's house, a Quaker house in Washington, where we had stayed when we didn't have any more money to stay in the YWCA. And somebody told me, the president's appointment secretary called you today, and I told him you'd gone home.
Oh.
And I said, oh, why did you just not tell him you'd take a message for me? So I called him back several times, but he never would answer me. I was back in Connecticut, so.
That is B-A, basic. That's basic. You don't give up that kind of information.
Right. You don't. But you know, some people just don't think quickly enough.
Right. Right.
So what was his name? Kenny something was the appointment secretary. He only died a year or two ago. I saw in the paper. So that was when. At least we got enough publicity so to help increase the awareness of nuclear testing and strontium-90. Mm-hmm. And of course, eventually they went to all underground testing, which is certainly not safe, but it's better than testing in the atmosphere, for sure.
How? What? Did you think of PRPE people like A. B. Abby Hoffman?
Oh.
Who C-A came after you.
Well, Abbie Hoffman was, you know, he was very influential with young people. And he was a genuine part of the peace movement. A lot of us felt that some of the antics he engaged in maybe weren't as helpful, but they appealed to, certainly to young people and got them involved. We had more problems with people who were not in the nonviolent movement, and they would often engage in trashing or, physical attacks and things. So on the East Coast, we always, always trained. That's part of what we did at the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action. We trained peacekeepers all the time for the demonstrations, in whether they were in Boston or Connecticut or New York or Washington. And I remember particularly one funny incident. It was the big demonstration in Washington at the Pentagon. I think it was 68, but I'm not sure of the year. But thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people came and marched to the Pentagon. And we stayed there for about 3 days and two nights. It was a whole weekend thing. And we trained a lot of people beforehand because we didn't want anybody to get into, get shot or to get into a ruckus. So we'd all marched to the Pentagon. It was a nice afternoon. And I was in charge of a crew of peacekeepers for a pretty big stretch of the Pentagon grounds. And some of my folks came and said, "What do we do about this man over here? He keeps urging people to rush the soldiers." Soldiers were lined up with guns in front of the Pentagon. You may remember the famous photo of the young woman putting a flower in the barrel of one of the soldiers' rifles. That was at that demonstration. And this man, he kept urging people. I went over near him and he was saying, "Come on, we can rush him. We can get through if just enough of us push on them. They won't shoot us. I don't think they'll shoot us." Mm. Well, so I got my group of peacekeepers together and I said, "Do what we practice, surround him and just keep talking to him nicely, but move him to the back." So that's what they did. The man was inside this circle and they just kept talking with him and explaining that that's not the way we conducted our demonstrations, and we would like for him to stop. And he kept urging that we should do a mass rush at the Pentagon. And they got him way to the back, and he disappeared. About an hour later, I looked up. There were a whole bunch of brass up on the Pentagon roof. And here was the same man. He had a bright plaid shirt on, so I recognized him. He was sent to try and start trouble. And he was an infiltrator, wow. In other words.
Wow. Yeah,
and I pointed him out to several people and said, "You did a good job."
Wow.
You know, so we not only had
that
to deal with...
I was thinking he... S sounded like a plant.
Mm-hmm. That's what he was.
Yeah. Wow.
So we not only had to deal with people in the peace movement who weren't committed to nonviolence, but we had to deal we discovered long afterwards that a man who came to the farm and whom we took in, he said he was AWOL, a deserter from the military, and he told us, my name that I'm using is not my own name, it's the name of a dead comrade of mine. And we took him in, and he stayed there for a year and a half or so. And we even had him working on our mailing list in the office. And at one point, we discovered that he and three other people were smoking marijuana, which was absolutely forbidden. We were in rural Connecticut, and we were already regarded as pinko commies, and so we had an absolute rule about no drugs. And we discovered it because they had been smoking in an upstairs room, and they came down for dinner, and they left a candle burning on one of the dressers with no candlestick, and the fire started. And when we put out the fire, and the fire department came and helped finish out the fire, which didn't get very far, but when we were cleaning up after the fire, we discovered marijuana butts and beer bottles and in that room, and so we told those people they had to leave the next day. But the denouement came several years later when one of our longtime staff members wrote Freedom Information to get some files about himself, and we discovered that this man had been giving all kinds of information to the government that was in the files. So you had to deal with infiltrators, and you had to deal with people who were not committed to nonviolence.
At the time, people thought we were paranoid. At the time, people thought that they were paranoid for thinking those things. But then after the fact, it was revealed that it was in fact true.
Well, it's certainly true of our last administration, Bush, who was his crowd, who were, of course, listening in on many phone conversations and interrupting many email messages and so forth. But I think it's always been true that the peace movement has been suspected, you know, in certain quarters. So they do take what they think are precautions. And of course, they don't want the peace movement to be too successful if they're pursuing a World War or a Vietnam War or a war in Iraq. They don't want the movement to grow, so they do everything they can to stop it. And that's what I hope that's not going to happen now. I greatly admire President Obama, and I feel that amazingly enough, despite all the racial attitudes in this country, that people in this country have sort of taken President Obama and his family to their hearts. I'm just amazed at his continuing good ratings and the acceptance and the interest in what they're doing, like the garden at the White House and the girls' school and so forth.
What? A. T. Are you true? L. What a truly? H. U. M. A. Human? A. K. can do, what a truly human person can do.
Yeah, that's right. And yet, he's insisting he's going to send a lot more troops to Afghanistan. That means more killing, more destruction. He's insisting on more drone planes, which are supposed to kill terrorists, but they kill many more civilians. And I cannot go along with this, and no Quakers can. We're all opposed to that, and pacifists in general. So we have to speak out and appeal. I think it's probably will get farther appealing to Obama than to somebody like Bush.
What was the DEA? What was the deal with N.I. Nixon? Who was a Quaker? What was the deal with Nixon, who was a Quaker?
Well, I don't think any Quakers like to claim Mr. Nixon. His mother was a Quaker. I don't believe that he was ever very active, but he was in the more conservative section of Quakerism in this country. There's a very progressive, liberal, committed to nonviolence grouping of Quakers, which is very large. But then there are also Quakers who are much more conservative in their religious views and in their political views. And that's what Nixon came out of. And I don't think he ever went to Quaker meeting in Washington once that I know of. So he was not a true Quaker, even though sometimes he he boasted about it.
It, N, E, it never, J, I, it never jived.
What?
It never jived, him and Quaker.
No, no, not at all. And, you know, I don't think people take Nixon as a Quaker very seriously and never did.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I never heard of him once going to Quaker meeting when he was president. So he's gone and well forgotten, I think, except for the damage he did to this country, which we have to make up for, you know.
What was the O.R. organization to, no, you and your husband started?
Oh, that was called the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action. The National Committee for Nonviolent Action started in the 50s. And the Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy started at the same time. And sane nuclear policy depended more on lobbying, on large gatherings, on publicity and so forth. The Committee for Nonviolent Action was committed to that, the nonviolent action, primarily in the issues of war and peace. And they, at the national level, they conducted projects like the Walk for Peace from San Francisco to Moscow, which followed questions that we got in New England when we were picketing the plant, which was producing nuclear-armed submarines, Polaris submarines, and the workers would say, why don't you go tell the Russians? So one of our members said, all right, we will. So we had to San Francisco to Moscow walk for peace. And people literally walked all the way across this country.
R.E. Don't give us ideas.
What?
Don't give us ideas.
Oh, you can have the idea. It's free.
No, he's saying that, yeah, like that person saying, why don't you go talk to Moscow?
Yeah.
Oh, that's giving us an idea.
Well, Obama says he's going to talk to Russia about nuclear weapons, and he hopes to get Russia to get rid of their stockpile, and we will get rid of our stockpile. Now, what you do about other nuclear nations, I guess they'll go on then and try to persuade Germany and, no, not Germany, France and England and India and Pakistan and Israel to give up their nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But that Walk for Peace was very effective in that it reached, of course, thousands of people across this country. They sailed to France and landed at Le Havre, and the French police kept putting them, throwing them back into the ocean or under the boat. So finally a French group walked the route through France, and then they walked all the way literally to Moscow. In fact, there was one young man that literally walked every step of the way. And the Russians wanted them to get in trucks and drive from town to town. They said, no, we're not doing that. The Russians got very anxious because they were about to test their big nuclear weapon. And so they didn't like the idea of our Walk for Peace. But they did get to Moscow. They were invited to speak at the large university in Moscow, and it was supposed to be a half-hour speech. The students would not let them go, and they were there all day. And it was quite, people joined them on the way from Europe, and even a man from Poland, which was a communist nation at that time, joined the walk, and it received a lot of publicity. And so I think it was effective in raising the issue of the nuclear arms race. Mm-hmm. And then later we had Quebec to Guantanamo Walk for Peace. That was right after the nuclear arms scare in Cuba. And that got stopped in as they left on a boat in Miami. The U.S. government is always arresting people in our boat projects when they have no right to, because they're out in the open sea. But that doesn't stop the U.S. government. They go and arrest the boat and the people. So they arrested the boat that was headed for Cuba and brought the boat and the people back. And there was a court case. And Bradford Little, who was the organizer, the project organizer, had named the boat Spirit of Freedom. So the federal court case had the name United States versus the Spirit of Freedom.
Oh, ouch.
And many times we won those court cases because the court said, of course, you can't arrest people in open sea. But it didn't make any difference. They kept doing it anyway. So we had a number of boat projects. So we had two or three into the testing area in the Pacific, one to protest Russian testing, nuclear testing. Got into boat projects, and we often had, we had several boats who took supplies to North Vietnam during the Vietnam War.
What was the DAIL dialogue daily? What was the daily LI life at the
Farm.
At the farm?
New England CNBA farm.
What was the daily life like?
In general, we usually had from 10 people there to 20 on staff, and we all worked for our boarding room and a dollar a week personal allowance. People gave us cars, they gave us clothing, they gave us money, they gave us all kinds of equipment. And every morning we would have breakfast, and then we would have a 10-minute planning session, because we tried to plan one trip into town in one car instead of four or five people going for different things. And we planned
what? For breakfast? What did you have for breakfast?
Well, what everybody has for breakfast. We had usually, we brought food in large quantities up in Providence at the market, you know, the wholesale market. But we would have fruit and eggs or cereal or pancakes. Some people were vegetarians, so we often didn't have bacon or... We often had vegetarian meals, but we did not. We weren't all vegetarian. And then we would plan who was going to work, who was going to do what projects we were planning, who had to go out and do field work. We were very careful to with our resources of money and human energy. But we also, we did an enormous amount, because we did a lot of local demonstrations at the electric boat company down in New London. But we also did walks and vigils and speaking tours all over New England, or to New York, or to Washington, or sent people to Saigon to demonstrate at the U.S. Embassy. So we always had a lot going on, and we had tremendous support, especially from around New England, but even people around the country supported us. And we did it for very little money.
Why? How? A. How about L. U. Lunch? What did you have for lunch, or did you have lunch?
For lunch, yeah, we usually made soup. Somebody would make a great big bowl of soup, and we'd have soup and cheese sandwiches or something. We got lots of boxes of fruit at the wholesale, so we always had fruit. And then, of course, we had a lot of conferences. We would have conferences anywhere from 25 to 150 people, or training programs in nonviolence. So we fed all those people also. And so sometimes we had a big crowd there, especially on a weekend. or in the summer we would have groups of young people, teenagers, come for training in nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even though we had maybe 10 to 20 people on staff, we often mm-hmm. had 40 people mm-hmm. at the farm, and that took a lot of planning and organizing.
How? What? How? A. How about the K I the kids?
The kids. Well, our kids, my children, the three younger ones went to local schools. My eldest daughter was in high school when we went to the farm, so she, one of our couple who were our supporters paid her tuition to go to the Quaker school in Ringe, New Hampshire, called the Meeting School. And then later, they also paid for my second daughter to go there. Mm-hmm. She went there for 2 years, I think. And
so they lived at the school?
And then my other children went to the elementary school. But Carol then went to middle school, to a Quaker school down in North Carolina. People paid their tuition as a way of supporting us, or they got scholarships. Mm. Scott went away to a school very early because the school in Voluntown was not very good, and he was very, very bright. By the time he'd finished fourth grade, he'd read every book in the library through eighth grade, and we felt he wasn't being challenged enough. Mm. So he went to what was called a farm home school up in New Hampshire. Mm. And then, so my kids went to a combination of public and private schools. And they all benefited from that. The girls were talking this afternoon about the Quaker schools they went to and how much they appreciated what they got from them. And the other children, there were other children at various times. Most of them were younger, not of school age. So we didn't have a school situation that we had to meet for them. Mm-hmm. Their families came and went from time to time. And one woman homeschooled her children. That was a, you know, it was a good to have the kids around, mm-hmm. and everybody helped to take care of the kids. Mm-hmm. And when we were raided once by a group called the Minutemen, a very violent group, several of the men ran and got children out of a cabin and a trailer and took them back into the woods. And unfortunately, the state police knew that raid was happening. They had somebody in the group that was an agent, and they let it happen anyway. And one of the men, raiding the place, one of the Minutemen was blinded for life as a result of being shot by a policeman in the face. One of our women almost died. She was shot with these World War I rifles that the Minutemen had, and she almost bled to death, but they got her to the hospital in time. And they were planning to round us all up and tie us up, steal our files, and burn all the buildings. And the police knew about this and they let some of it happen because they the state police wanted to scare us and try to get us to go away. And when we went to see the director of the state police after it was all over, he said, well, you see, if you would just close down the farm and leave, these things wouldn't happen. We didn't close down the farm. We built a new conference center and we kept on going. That was the second raid by the Minutemen, which was a very violent, a very conservative group. And the first time they burned down our barn with a lot of records and things in it. And then the second time was the shootout. And we had a lot of problems with young people from the surrounding communities coming and setting off firecrackers or standing in our driveway and yelling or throwing a burning cross in. We never called the police on them. What we did was to go see their parents. We got to know them. We went to see their parents or we went to see their priests. And interestingly enough, a couple of them became conscientious objectors to the Vietnam War and asked us for counseling. And another one was killed in the war, and his mother ran the local store downtown. And when we were going to the Pentagon for that project, I said, we're going to march to the Capitol and we're going to stop in front of the White House and call out the names of people who've been victims of the war. May I call out your son's name? And she started crying and she thanked me. And what we did slowly, you know, I was invited to be the speaker at the 8th grade graduation in the local school in 1969. Now, the adults quickly put a squash on that, so I didn't get to be the speaker. But that's what the students voted, the 8th graders. Wow. So we had an effect right in that community. And we also had a number of people quit working at Electric Boat. Some of them came and lived with us. And we were always having sailors and other people in the armed services come to us for counseling. And I can tell you, my husband and I took a lot of family members across the Canadian border for a family vacation, but we came back alone left the soldiers and sailors and their families, they had them in Canada, where they were warmly welcomed during the Vietnam War.
Wow. In S-A-N, Santa Fe, in the early 70s, we opened a a center
in Santa Fe,
yes.
New Mexico.
Yes, at first the C H I Chicano locals. G T H threatened T H R E through C H E R R cherries be cherry bombs.
Oh, the center.
Yes,
yeah.
At the center.
Uh-huh. Did they stop later?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it still there?
No.
No. Oh, that's too bad.
But six M O months later, M O most of the S A same K I kids who had been throwing the cherry bombs were no S T A started
coming into the center.
Uh-huh. Started coming into the center.
Yeah.
And S T started their own center. Started
mm-hmm.
their own center.
Mm-hmm. We had the same thing happen. Mm-hmm. We had an office in New London for the first few years, and the kids would come in and wreck things and throw stuff around. But then they started to come back and help to clean it up.
They R E A really R E A L I they realized we were not the enemy.
Enemy. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And I think today most young people, you know, a great many young people registered and voted for Obama, for instance, and I think they have a very different attitude than they did during the Cold War about peace people and about the necessity of changing our values and our national policies. And I have a lot of hope for the young people of today.
Mm-hmm. U H A had a F U N a fun L I life F U full of A D adventure. You've had a fun life full of adventure.
Well, that's true. It's been serious, but it's been fun. It's been rewarding. Let's put it that way. My children and I were talking about that at dinner today, and they had some pictures that we hadn't all seen of when they were young and when we were on some of the projects. And my children have never been quite as, quote, radical as I was, but each one of them, in his or her own way, has taken up the values that we tried to teach them. So my son works with Habitat for Humanity. He's a builder, and occasionally he'll go help them. My oldest daughter was on the faculty at Cabrillo College, and her job was counseling, especially young people or foreign students or students whose families had never gone to college, and she did wonderful things for them. And when she died last year, a lot of them came to the celebration of her life and stood up and told their stories. My third daughter is a mortgage broker. You know, where her business and her brother's business are in the tank now.
Uh-huh.
But she has always helped people to that might not be able to own homes to get mortgages. Not the subprime mortgages, but she's looked, and we have a family fund from some money that was left from a condo that I once owned, and we would approve her lending them money to help with the down payment, and every cent has gotten paid back.
Wow.
And then my younger daughter has had a school at the Ellis Arts Center in Oakland for years, and she not only teaches dance and voice and theater, but she teaches nonviolent conflict resolution. And
she was a, she was on the show.
Yes, yeah. That's Carol Swan, yes. So all my children have, in one way or another, adopted our values in their work and in their lives. Mm. And I'm very appreciative of that, because some kids reject everything their parents believe.
Yes. One of our kids is that has rejected everything, at least at this point in his life, is one. The other one seems to have embraced it. You, W-U-E, you have no C O N T control over that.
No,
one
we don't.
One has no control over that.
No, we don't.
Yeah.
And we need to love our children no matter what direction they go in, because especially if they have children, the grandchildren are very likely to want to know what their grandparents believe and do. And my grandson is already asking me questions and drawing pictures, peace pictures for me. He's not quite 10.
Q, will, like what kind of questions is he asking you?
Oh, he'll see a magazine or an article on the bulletin board, and he'll want to know about what's that about, Grandma. Or he'll draw what he calls a peace picture and color it and send it to me. He's not quite 10 yet, so he's already thinking about things, and I give him books. I give him books I get from the Quaker bookstore in Philadelphia, or that I find in bookstores. I actively try to educate him in that direction.
You, W, E, went to P, A, Paris? You went to Paris?
I went to Paris, yes, I went twice. A friend of mine and I got an idea for called Women Volunteers to Vietnam, because we were not getting through the news sources you know, very realistic pictures of what was happening to the people in Vietnam. So we decided to enlist women, not just peace women, but any women who felt they wanted to go and spend 3 or 4 months in Vietnam with a Vietnamese family, either in a rural area or a city, and then come back and report, especially in their local papers and radio stations and so forth, so that American people would get a much better idea of what was going on there and what was happening to the people. So we went, went to Paris. We had first gone to England to a triennial conference of the War Resisters International, which has been an organization since World War I. And then we went to Paris and we met with people in the NLF, National Liberation Front. That was the South Vietnamese who were struggling against the U.S. government and their own government, their own South Vietnamese government, which was a tool of the U.S. And we saw the North Vietnamese peace delegation. We met with Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a quite a famous Buddhist monk who is really known worldwide, probably after the Dalai Lama. He's the best known Buddhist in the world. And we met with another Buddhist group of Buddhist monks who felt they had to support the armed struggle. And we presented them with our plan. And they all took it very seriously, and they said they would think about it. A few months later, we went back to Paris. And this was in January of, let's see, about 73, after the supposed peace plan had been signed. And you remember that Kissinger and the Vietnamese man got the Nobel Peace Prize for that. And but in all honesty, we didn't believe the United States was going to stick to that. But we went back and we were invited to a luncheon of a number of people who were there to celebrate the signing of this peace treaty. And we were asked, I had been fasting for 22 months on liquids only. I only took liquids for 22 months as a protest. And so we were, I had decided to break my fast there. And we were invited by Madame Binh, the head of the NLF delegation, to sit at her table and eat with her and her top assistant, Madame Min. And then we went to Rome for an international conference on Southeast Asia. And that was a fascinating occurrence because there were people there from Cambodia and Laos and all over the world. And when we went back to Paris, we talked again with these four different groups, and obviously they had talked together, we were sure of that. But they told us that they felt that they could not accept American women in Vietnam because they didn't want to be responsible for their being killed by U.S. bombings. And it was already clear that the U.S. was not going to abide by the peace agreement. So they said, would you instead try to raise some money? Our Buddhist nuns are just overwhelmed with orphans. We have so many orphans in the country, and we just, they couldn't keep up with taking care of them. The orphanages were just packed and not enough food and the rest. So we we agreed to that, and we came back, and we raised thousands of dollars, and we divided it among the four groups. But part of what was interesting about the project, one of the women's magazines, I think it was Ladies Home Journal, got hold of our idea, and they put it in the a squib in their magazine. And we got these letters from women all over the country. One woman from, I think it was Alabama or Mississippi, wrote and said, "Well, I've never driven water buffalo, but I drive mules all the time, so I think I could be of some help." And another woman said, "My job is cleaning rooms in a motel, so I think I could be of help to a mother and her children." Those, we didn't want to just take peace people. We wanted to take, quote, regular women from across the country. And we just got the an amazing response. Later, Louise, my friend, did get to North Vietnam. She went with a group which was protesting at the U.S. Embassy in South Vietnam. As usual with those groups, they got kicked out. And she and another person in the group went to Vientiane in Laos and got visas for North Vietnam. And they went there and they met some of the people that we had known in Paris. And wow. And they did get to North Vietnam, but first to South Vietnam and then North Vietnam. But I've never been, and I would still love to go sometime. That's the place I most want to go in the world.
A. H. I. N. T. A hint. A hint. Oh, for what those listening and watching. That's a hint that you would. That's the place you would most want to go if anybody. Out there.
Oh, yeah. If anybody out there wants to buy an air ticket, that's fine. I don't think it's ever going to happen. I got to know people in this country, Vietnamese people. The ones in this country were not all in support of the South Vietnam government. And one time, after Kissinger and the North Vietnamese man, whose name I'm sorry I've forgotten, got the Nobel Peace Prize, all the peace groups in New England got together and they gave the alternative Nobel Peace Prize. I was the American recipient, and a young man who was from Vietnam and who eventually was put in prison by our government for openly opposing the war was the Vietnamese who received it. So we were we got a peace prize.
A. R. E. A. L. A real one. A real peace prize.
Yes, yes. For true peace. Work for true peace, yeah. Right.
Is that it? Yeah, I think that's gonna be it then.
Yeah, that's quite a long talk. I really enjoyed it.
Who tell everybody your name?
My name is Marjorie Swan Edwin, and I've been in the nonviolence movement, I think it's 75 years now. I was 13 when I started. I didn't even know I was in the movement at that point.
Wow.
I just got involved in a situation at school where white parents didn't want their students to go to school with black kids, so they pulled them out, and I kept on going to school because I didn't see any point in not going to school. They were, a lot of them were my friends. So that was Chicago. So Chicago is very famous, you know, famously governed by the Democratic Party, but the precinct I lived in was the only Republican precinct in the whole city. So the mayor and the city council and the school board were going to pay no attention to those parents who pulled their kids out of school to get rid of the black kids. So that was my introduction. But I didn't even know anything about anything, except I just thought it was stupid not to go to school with kids together.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was the beginning.
Wowee. Okay, well, good night, everybody.